Well, hello. My name is Angele Wood, and this is Crime of the Truest Kind. Hey, everyone, welcome back. It is June now, for real, so maybe we can enjoy some sea and sand. That's what I intend to do in a few weeks when I go to Cape Cod here on the beautiful shores of Massachusetts. It is my birthday weekend, so you're up to date. I always want to start the show off by thanking you all so very much for the support you have shown to this show in our very short existence. This is episode 19. That's not a lot. Especially being a bi-weekly podcast, I don't even issue episodes every week. So your attention and feedback is awesome. Thank you for that. Thank you to contributors supporting the show via Buy Me a Coffee, Laura R. and Maddie D. Maddie Cigars. Thank you very much. I appreciate all of your support. It keeps the show afloat. You can contribute to the show if you so choose, buymeacoffee.com/truestkind. It is also linked on the webpage, as is everything else about the show, crimeofthetruestkind.com. Links how to listen. You can listen right there through the website. All the source links are listed on every episode page. And how to follow the show. Crime of the Truest Kind on Facebook and Instagram, at Truest Kind on Twitter and TikTok. Your reviews are incredible and very helpful in building the show. I got a new one that I haven't read on the show yet. I got it on Audible. Firstly, I didn't know I was on Audible. And secondly, I didn't know you could do reviews on Audible. So thank you, Hannah. Angele is my new favorite podcaster. Listen to every episode in just 4 days. Absolutely adore AW's narration style. Well-researched also. Thank you very much, Hannah. Incredible. I believe I am all caught up on sharing reviews. I do share them on Instagram stories as well. So thank you, everyone. If there's anyone among you that hasn't gotten a Crime of the Truest Kind care pack, please do send me a message via email, or you can message me on Instagram, however you choose. I'll mail out a little care pack to show you my appreciation. During today's show, I will share another podcast promo. So listen up for Podcast by Proxy by Katie and Olivia. I appreciate their support. We did a little promo swap. Most of you know that I have grown up in the New England area, and the focus of this podcast is crimes from around New England. Now, I haven't touched on this yet. Today's episode deals with the Boston Police Department. Later in the show, I talk to journalist and author Dave Wedge. This is the story of Victoria Snellgrove, Boston, Massachusetts. Okay, I thought I could get away with it, but Otis the Bulldog is here, so you're probably going to hear some snorty sounds. He's very much part of the show now. Right, buddy? Boston, Massachusetts, a city that I love, a city that I know well, a city that I have spent a lot of time in. Boston is known as the hub. We don't say Beantown. If you say Beantown, you're not from here, or you're a witty TV producer, or you write for the New York Post, or you've just moved to Connecticut. Boston is a small city, covering 48 square miles with an estimated population of just over 692,000 people. That's as of 2019. It is the largest city in all of New England. The city just got its first black woman, first black person to become mayor of Boston ever this year, when now former mayor Marty Walsh was appointed labor secretary for the Biden administration. Mayor Kim Janey grew up in the city. When she was 11, Mayor Janey attended school in Charlestown. She was right in the middle of busing. It was Boston's very controversial court-mandated school desegregation plan. I talk a lot about it in the Whitey Bulger episode. Episodes. Go check out 1 and 2. She was appointed as mayor when Mayor Marty Walsh moved on. And she is a remarkable woman with a remarkable story. She had a daughter at 16. She graduated from high school. She attended community college. She started college at Smith, but stopped to take care of her grandfather when her grandmother died. She is a remarkable example of determination, regardless of party affiliation. Boston and the region, because when you're from around Boston, it's still kind of Boston. It's home to all 40 Wahlbergs. Amy Poehler grew up in the suburbs and went to Boston University. Howard Stern also went to BU. Rachel Dratch is from around here. John Krasinski's from around here. Matt LeBlanc is from around here. Olympia Dukakis, Michael Bloomberg, Maura Tierney, Christina Lease, all one-time locals. Jasmine Guy was born here, as was Allison Janney, Barbara Walters, Edward Norton. Loads of comics from Boston. We were like the comedy capital for a while. Conan O'Brien, Jay Leno, Stephen Wright, Dane Cook. A lot of people call him a tool, but still from around here. Lenny Clark. He's like the godfather of comedy around here. Patrice O'Neill is from here. Steve Carell's from around here. Dennis Leary is from here. The Dresden Dolls are from here. Tons of rock and roll bands and performers like The Cars, Aerosmith, Jay Giles Band. They always come to mind. Oh, and the Dropkick Murphys, who do not have the market cornered on the Boston sound, and not everything includes a bagpipe. Juliana Hatfield, The Pixies, Michael Christmas, Cousin Stiz, Dutch Rebel, Latrell James. Donna Summers from Boston, New Edition, Slane. He has Ben Affleck money now, so he's living in the burbs. Ed OG's from here, Acrobatic, Mr. Lift, Still Gold. Boston is a great hip-hop town. It's a great rock town, but it's very much a hip-hop town. And I just laid out a very substantial list, and it's just a fraction. Boston is a massive sports town. It is a religion here. It's like going to church. But we were Loserville for a very long time. I remember watching the Patriots games when I was a kid from the old Sullivan Stadium. They were garbage. There are a total of 44 institutions of higher education in the area that bring, on average, 250,000 students into the region every year. On the night of October 20th, 2004, emotions were running high. From late nights, big stakes, history about to be made. For this to make sense, you need to have an understanding of the history of the Red Sox and the curse, a mentality that propagated through the region for 86 years. A brief history of the team, very brief. This is not a sports story. And I am not a delirious New England sports fan. I am fair weather at best. Though Tom Brady is a GOAT, but right behind Simone Biles. She's not from here, unfortunately. The team was originally known as the Boston Americans and won the first World Series in 1903. In 1907, the team changed their name to the Boston Red Sox. To date, the Red Sox have won 9 World Series championships, the most recent, 2018. But there was a massive 86-year gap that began in 1918. That's the year they sold Babe Ruth to the Yankees. That's the year the curse of the Bambino began. And that is also the year the greatest rivalry on earth was born. There was the 1986 championship season that ended in utter heartbreak. Diehards remember the play. At the bottom of the 10th inning at Chase Stadium, the Mets were down 5-3. 2 outs, no one on base. Their batters rallied, knocking 3 consecutive singles off pitcher Calvin Schiraldi, driving a run, leaving runners on first and third. I sound like I know a lot about sports, and I don't. The ball went through Bill Buckner's legs in Game 6 of the matchup between the Red Sox and the New York Mets. It was at first base that he made the error that would haunt him forever. Boston, facing the Mets, was looking for its first World Series championship since 1918, thus crushing the curse. Now, there has always been a massive rivalry between the Boston Red Sox and the Yankees, sometimes ridiculous, often embarrassing. While it does make for a great comedy skit, Red Sox fans often use the infamous Yankee suck phrase to beat each other adieu. It goes something like this. Hey guy, let's meet at Pizzeria Uno's. Cool, see you there. Yankees suck. The person who is most important in this story is Victoria Snellgrove. Tori, to her friends and family. And while I want to humanize her in death, I often feel like using someone's nickname is invasive. And I'm an outlier in her story. Victoria E. Snellgrove was born October 29, 1982. She grew up in East Bridgewater, a small town of about 13,500 people, 33 miles south of the city of Boston. The actor Tom Everett Scott is from there, I learned. He's in movies and on TV shows. He did Southland, Oh, That Thing You Do, Boiler Room. He was in La La Land, and I don't really remember his character, but I believe he was Emma Stone's husband at the very end of the movie. Victoria attended East Bridgewater High School, where she played field hockey. She ran track. She was on the tennis team. She was in the drama class and the Key Club. I didn't know what a Key Club was, so I looked it up. It's like student leadership. Victoria loved music and photography. She played the piano. She rode horses. After graduating in 2001, she went to Fitchburg State College, where she studied journalism and completed an internship at Disney World in Florida. In 2003, while in her sophomore year, she transferred to Emerson College, one of the country's premier institutions for higher learning devoted to communications and the arts. I took that off their Facebook page. She had been selected by Emerson College to complete her studies and internship in the fall of 2005 at the school's Los Angeles campus. That had to be incredibly exciting. She was on course to graduate in the spring of 2006. The professors at Emerson recognized her drive and her skill and were guiding her to dig into all facets of the business: street reporting, assembling studio broadcasts, writing scripts, and they wanted her to get exposure in front of the camera. She was on track for all of that and scheduled to meet with her advisors to begin planning her career path. Victoria wanted to follow in the footsteps of some of the most recognized broadcasters of the time. I think of people like Barbara Walters and Oprah Winfrey, Cokie Roberts. Cokie was politics, but I like the name Cokie. Her friends said she talked about wanting to be on E! Entertainment Television, which does still exist. She wanted to be famous like Jules Asner and talk to celebrities on the red carpet. Now, Jules Asner left the E! Channel in 2003. The modern-day equivalent to Jules Asner today would be Juliana Rancic, Maria Menounos. Maria is from Medford, by the way. Robin Roberts. Who's the Saved by the Bell guy? Mario Lopez. He does Access Hollywood. I don't watch a lot of television, but you get my point. Friends spoke of how she knew what she wanted, and she wasn't afraid to go for it. In a story from the Boston Globe written in May 2005, after her family settled a lawsuit with the city of Boston, they spoke of a videotape they had found shortly after she died. She spoke of one of her biggest fears. It was dying suddenly. She seemed to recognize the fragility of life and was grateful for her circle of support. She spoke of her passion for broadcast journalism and that a boyfriend and marriage and children would have to wait. She would enthusiastically audition for news anchor slots at Emerson College's on-campus television network. Her positive vibe, coupled with her no-nonsense delivery, left an impression on her fellow would-be broadcasters. Those who knew her spoke of her intense focus, her sweet nature, and that she had her whole life in front of her. But she didn't. She got killed 8 days before her 22nd birthday. She was hit in the face with a Boston Cops riot gear pepper bullet. It was during an out-of-control celebration following the Red Sox victory over the New York Yankees in the final game of the American League Championship Series. When classmates in the broadcast journalism school heard she died from her injuries, they went to work on a video tribute to her. Her audition tape had surfaced, and some students watched in private the last images of their animated and ambitious friend. She had been scheduled to anchor a newscast the following week. When her family spoke about her, they told of her love of the Red Sox. She was a commuter student, making the drive from East Bridgewater to the Boston campus in the heart of the Back Bay, very close to the Boston Marathon finish line. On that Wednesday night, she decided to drive into the city to join her friends in Kenmore Square for the big game, seventh in the series against the Yankees. High stakes. In the early hours of October 21st, 2004, after the Red Sox defeated the Yankees at Yankee Stadium in Game 7 of the series, the Boston Police Department took action around Fenway Park to try to contain the massive crowds that had gathered on Lansdowne Street, the street that Fenway Park empties into, opposite Yawkey Way, that was renamed Jersey Street. You follow? Everybody came out of the woodwork. Rowdy revelers, drunken dummies, escalating the tension, throwing bottles at police, climbing up the light posts. In the second half of this episode, I will speak to David Wedge, journalist and author and former reporter with the Boston Herald, who was on Lansdowne Street that night. Sometime after the game ended, and in the chaos of the out-of-control crowds, an officer named Rochford Million shot Victoria with an FN-303 blunt trauma pepper pellet projectile. Victoria was not the intended target, nor was she behaving in any way that might get a cop's attention in a near riot. He had fired at a different person in the crowd, and the crowd-controlled projectile hit her in the eye, causing her to bleed heavily. The crowds made it difficult for an ambulance to get through. Police were having trouble moving the crowd. It was obvious to anyone who was in the area of that sidewalk where Victoria fell that she was badly hurt. An ambulance arrived, she was rushed to the hospital, and her parents were contacted. That call came from one of her friends at 1:35 in the morning. Her mother, Diane, answered. Mrs. Snellgrove and Victoria's father, Richard, not able to comprehend what they were just told, drove as fast as humanly possible from their home in East Bridgewater to Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston to be with their daughter.
Hi, friends. I'm Olivia.
And I'm Katie.
We are Podcast by Proxy, a Canadian true crime podcast.
Our primary focus is Canadian cases, but sometimes we travel south of the border and love listener suggestions.
Join us every Tuesday where we talk about some of the not-so-polite Canadians.
You can find us at Podcast by Proxy wherever you listen to your podcasts and on all social media platforms.
So his employer eventually finds out about his criminal past, though, and releases him from employment. He gets a job selling hot dogs on Main Street for a while before he lands a permanent job as a salad maker for G&G Foods, and he worked, like, late overnights at this job.
So this guy literally tossed salads for a living?
Correct.
Okay. A murderous salad tosser.
Oh, lordy.
As difficult as it was for parents who were there to fix everything for her, they couldn't fix this. Victoria Snellgrove died at 12:50 p.m. at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, about 12 hours after she was shot. According to the autopsy, the pellet opened a 3/4-inch hole in the bone behind her eye. It broke into 9 pieces and damaged the right side of her brain. Boston Police Commissioner Kathleen O'Toole placed the officer who shot Victoria on Lansdowne Street that night on a paid leave. They would open an investigation as to what happened and how to prevent it from happening again. Victoria's funeral took place on October 26, 2004, at St. John's Catholic Church in East Bridgewater. Police Commissioner O'Toole attended, as did then-Mayor of Boston, Thomas Menino, and the governor at the time, Mitt Romney. Red Sox owner John Henry attended her wake. Curt Schilling sent flowers. There was a moment of silence for Victoria at Game 1, 2004 World Series Cardinals versus the Red Sox. The Boston Red Sox swept the Cardinals in 4 games and reversed the curse on October 27th, 2004. The city went nuts. I remember dancing in the streets in Cambridge. I hope Victoria was watching those games from wherever she is. In 2005, a year after Victoria's death, a 55-page report was issued by the commission set up to investigate her shooting death. It was determined to be an accidental shooting. None of the officers involved were charged. And it was determined that the officers who were given the FN-303 projectile guns were not trained on how to use them. The Snellgrove family filed suit against the city of Boston. They won a $5 million judgment in the shooting death of their daughter, Victoria Snellgrove. They also filed suit against the makers of the FN-303 pepper pellet projectile gun. Information regarding that settlement was not made public. We can only wonder where Victoria Snellgrove's career would have taken her. Would she be hosting her own show? Talking to celebrities on the red carpet? I'd like to think that she would be. I'd like to think that Victoria Snellgrove would come back to Emerson and be celebrated for the work that she had done in broadcast journalism. The Snellgrove family have been driven by their tragedy and have built playgrounds in Victoria's name. Tori's Place 6 is now at the Bridgewater Girls Softball League fields, paid for by the family's nonprofit, the Tory Fund. They also fund 2 scholarships at East Bridgewater High School and an endowment at Emerson College. More about the fund at victoriasnellgrove.org. Part 2 of this episode has a guest. My guest is Dave Wedge. He's been on the show before. He's a former reporter with the Boston Herald. His work has appeared in Vice, Esquire, Dig Boston, Newsweek, Revolver. He's now an author. He wrote the book Boston Strong about the Marathon bombing, which became a film, Patriots Day, with his co-author, Casey Sherman. Dave Wedge co-wrote the book that inspired this podcast, Hunting Whitey. He and his co-author, Casey Sherman, also have a true crime podcast, Saints, Sinners, and Serial Killers. This is my conversation with Dave Wedge, and it's via Zoom.
How you doing?
I'm fantastic. How about you?
I'm good, good, busy, you know, just getting stuff done and happy to do this for you. You know, I'm like a regular contributor now.
I love it. I love it.
How's the podcast doing?
It's going great. The feedback from people is just so good.
Great. That's
you know,
great.
Like I get a lot of messages from people who are just discovering it and they share, you know, ideas for new episodes. And I love that. I love that people are finding it and getting in touch with me.
Well, it's a cool idea and it's awesome. So I'm glad you're doing it. So
thank you. Thank
any
you.
Way I can help.
Yeah. I mean, you are a really great resource because,
well,
I mean,
you
worked at the Herald for so long and then, you know, all of the books that you've been writing. I mean, this is kind of, I mean, I know that you guys got in the podcast game too.
Yeah, so we have ours, and you know, we're admittedly treading on similar territory, but we're doing, you know, it's weird. I mean, I covered most of these stories that you're doing.
I know you did.
I covered most of them at the Herald because I covered a bunch of wild stuff, you know. But Casey and I, it's a little different. Like ours is more like immersive storytelling. Like I don't know if you listen, but
it's
like script. Like we're scripted. We're like sound design, all that stuff, and. You know, we're doing 10 episodes and then next season will be 10 episodes. And we're doing some interview stuff in between, but we're really like picking targets like for a reason, you know, and it's doing great. Podcast is doing great. So,
yeah, it is a ferocious place. I had no idea how engaged the audience was and how the whole genre operated. I mean, I came into this from being a radio person and having a totally different perspective, and people have been really cool.
Well, look at Kirk Minahan's. I mean, his podcast was like the number 2 podcast in the country when it came out, you know, and it's just, that's just a old cold case, you know.
And he's got the backing of what, Barstool Sports or something?
Yeah, he's got Barstool. So I mean, that obviously that's a bit of a game changer, you know.
But
and he has a big audience on his own as well. So, but it's, you know, it just shows you the power of the medium, you know, in this genre.
I agree, and radio has been destroying itself. So to move to a medium like podcasting, it's like without the music. It's what radio was.
Yeah. It's awesome. It's great. Well, you know, you have a great voice and you've got a great way of what you're doing with your episodes. So keep it up. And like I said, I'm happy to jump on anytime.
Cool. let's set the scene. You started at the Herald's, at the Boston Herald in 1999.
That's right. Yep.
So you covered Boston Marathon bombing. I know you chased that story for a while. I know you've covered a lot of Whitey Bulger. You wrote a book about it. I know that you covered the Station nightclub fire, which I did a 3-part series, which is a fascinating story. Sad, but fascinating. So much of what's happened in New England, you've been a part of. So let's set the scene for what happened in Boston in 2004. Now, it seems like yesterday, but also it was so long ago. It was October. Students were packed tight into the city. The Red Sox were playing the Yankees, bitter rivals. On the night of October 20th, 2004, the Red Sox clinched the championship and they are going to the World Series. Now, they had gone to the World Series before, but it had been 86 years since they won, thus perpetuating the curse of them Bambino. So we have to set up the whole Boston thing. Revelers flood into the streets. Thousands head to Fenway Park. It was an away game, so no, the team wasn't there. And Boston Police Department was not ready.
Yeah, so it was, thank you for that welcome. I'm happy to be back on your show. There's a couple of things to help kind of set the scene here. So, you know, Boston, as you said, the Red Sox went to the World Series in 86 and had our heart broken. You know, we all remember that, the ball between Buckner's legs. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, so the curse of Bambino had continued. And the only real reprieve that the Celtics won some titles after that. In 1986, they won a title. And then 2001 was the really when Boston kind of broke its drought of titles. Like, now it's nothing new for a Boston team to win a title, but it wasn't like that in the 80s and 90s. It was a drought.
You know, the Patriots were horrible for a long time.
They were a doormat for, you know, 25, 30 years. They were laughed. They were the Jets and the Bills, you know?
Yeah.
But, you know, they won in 2001, you know, right after 9/11. And then when 2004 came around, you know, the Red Sox were down 3-0 against the Yankees, the team that they traded Babe Ruth to. So, in the newsroom at the Herald, you know, there was a few things that we always talked about being huge stories. One was, you know, obviously a terror attack after 9/11. Another was, you know, we always talked about the plane crashes at Logan. Like, you know, some night there'll be a plane crash at Logan and that'll be a big story. Another was finding Whitey Bulger. When they find Whitey Bulger, drop your life, you're going to be running to catch Whitey Bulger. And the other one was if the Red Sox ever win the World Series.
Yeah.
And what happened in 2004 that night was, you know, the Red Sox did something no one in baseball history had ever done, which is come back from 3-0 to beat the Yankees in Yankee Stadium. Mm-hmm. So we were on our way to, you know, lifting the curse of the Bambino. And now it seems silly because the Red Sox won three or four World Series since then. But it was a huge thing. And again, in 2001, they had a big rally after the Patriots won. So the Boston police were kind of learning how to deal with the stuff, but they still didn't know. And what happened down there at Fenway Park was exactly what you said. The Boston police were not ready for it. The city wasn't ready for it. I think it was an away game, so they didn't expect what happened. And what happened was, I'll back up. I mean, my job that night was I was on standby. Mm-hmm. And my boss said, look, why don't you head down towards Fenway? If the Red Sox win or lose, there may be some trouble. So why don't you get down there? I went down there. I was living in Dorchester at the time. And I went down to Fenway. And there was, you know, as the game went on, it became clear the Red Sox were going to pull this off and win. And the kids started coming. And, you know, sure enough, Lansdowne Street was an absolute mob scene. And
walk me through it. You go there. You're witnessing what's happening. You know it's all out pandemonium.
Yeah.
And then the last thing anybody wanted to happen was somebody got hurt and died as a result of the Boston Police Department's inability to plan for this. And they brought these less lethal weapons that shot pepper bullets.
So there's a lot to this, and I know everything there is to know about the FN-303, which is the gun they were using, because after this incident that I'm about to tell you happened, my job was to investigate why it happened, and I spent the next 3 to 4 months doing that. So another thing happened before this night. In 2004, Boston hosted the Democratic National Convention, And I covered that. I was part of the team, and I covered the protests. And Boston actually set up what was called a protest pen for that, where the it was high security. You know, John Kerry, Obama made his first big appearance, and no one knew who he was, but that was where he did his first major political speech, was at the DNC at the Boston Garden.
Yeah.
And I was down there, and there was some violence down there. I was down there when there was some pretty significant violence on Canal Street, and you know, the police arrested a lot of people, and there was people throwing things and things like that. But it was kind of a new thing for Boston to deal with this, like, rioting, quote unquote. Now, you know, we see protests get out of control all the time, but then it didn't happen. After the DNC, the Boston police purchased these weapons that were called the FN-303, supposedly less lethal. By definition, can be lethal. Everybody knew that. The training on them is supposed to be that you shoot at the legs and you scare the people and they run off. So here's what happened that night. I got down to Lansdowne Street before the game was over, and I got onto the, there's a two-deck parking garage next to the Gold's Gym. It's still there. And there was a couple of media members standing on that top platform. So I had like a bird's eye view of Lansdowne Street as the crowd was coming in. And there was a TV crew next to me from CBS National, and there was like another local affiliate there. And, you know, when you're on those stakeouts with other reporters, you're just hanging out, you know, shooting the breeze, whatever. And it's really, you know, kind of weird to think about. But I happened to notice Victoria Snellgrove and her friends. You know, I noticed them because they were very pretty. They were good-looking girls.
Yeah.
And they were standing literally right below me. You know, a couple of them appeared pretty drunk. They were getting sausages because there was a sausage cart right
there. Sausage guy.
They were getting sausages from the sausage guy. So I noticed them. And one of them was smoking a cigarette. And you know, the crowd got really, really dense. Really dense. Really fast. And anyone that's been in this sort of situation knows how fast it escalates. So I'm standing there, and, you know, my job is to kind of observe and, you know, watch what happens. And I'm going to report back later on and write a story. So after a while, the police started trying to herd people around, and then the horses came in, police on horseback. And what happened was one of the kids in the crowd actually stabbed one of the horses with a pencil.
Oh.
And the horse went nuts, and the horse started jumping around and going crazy. And then kids started throwing bottles. And they were actually throwing Molotov cocktails. They were throwing flaming bottles. And there was kids climbing the Green Monster at Fenway Park, the outside. They were scaling it. There was probably 15, 20 kids climbing this thing. And it quickly devolved into chaos. Kids were running around. Cops were running around. Reinforcements came in. And then at some point, I think it was Superintendent Dunford made the call to pull out the FN-303s. I didn't know that at the time. I learned that later, but I did see the guns come out, and I saw kids running. I saw kids. I saw a kid fall off the Green Monster that apparently had gotten shot with one of these things. And what happened next was I happened to be looking back down directly below me at the three girls, and I saw Victoria Snellgrove go down like a ton of bricks. I just saw her fall. And she fell flat on her back, and I ran down there because she was, you know, 20 feet away from me. And I ran down, and as I got down there, there was a police officer that was surrounding them, and people that were friends with them were trying to get around them. I said to the police officer, "Get an ambulance, get an ambulance." And I said to one of the girls, I said, "Is she okay? Is she okay?" She said, "I don't know." And she was crying. The girl was in shock. And then one of the young men that was with them said, "The fucking cop shot her."
Wow.
The fucking cops shot her. And, you know, when you're in that situation, everybody hates the cops. And I had been in that situation a million times. So I was like, yeah, okay, the cops shot her. Yeah, sure. And then some other kid said, "No, someone threw a bottle at her. I saw her. They hit her with a bottle." And I looked down, and she had blood just pouring out of her mouth and blood pouring out of her eye. And then the police came in full force and forced everyone out. They were, you know, threatening to arrest everyone, and they just forced us down to the other end of Lansdowne Street towards Kenmore Square. So I didn't know what happened, but I knew she was severely injured,
yeah,
possibly dead. You know, I finished my reporting. You know, there was not much other There's a lot of yelling and screaming, people breaking windows and smashing car windows and things like that. But I went back to the Herald. You know, I told one of my bosses, I said, I wrote my story, and I said, listen, I think a girl was killed down there. And I said, I don't know what happened. I said she either got shot by the police or hit with a bottle. I'm not sure which one, so we can't report it. And the police gave us no information. Obviously, it was midnight, 1 a.m. by then. So what we reported that was that, you know, a young woman was severely injured. No further information at this time. Went home, went to bed. The next morning, I woke up and, you know, I got a text at 5:30, 6 in the morning from my editor. He was like, hey, you were right. You know, that girl died. And I was like, Jesus Christ, you know, I watched this young girl die, you know. And to be honest with you, as I sit here telling the story, I haven't thought about it in many years, but it has haunted me that I saw that happened. It was a night that should have been a celebratory, amazing night in Boston, and it turned into a real tragedy for that family. And then, you know, the next day I spent, you know, I found out who she was and that she went to Emerson and she was from Bridgewater, which I'm from Brockton. So I was like, Jesus, from the next town over. And, you know, I covered the story going forward. And then I started investigating the guns and what happened. And I'll always be very upset by what happened out there on Lansdowne Street that night.
It's horrifying. Yep. It's absolutely horrifying. You don't imagine that your kid is going to go, you know, celebrate a baseball game. And she was Victoria Snellgrove was a big Red Sox fan. She died in the hospital later that day. It was very, very grim. God bless her family for having to face all of that. Do you remember when the Herald, it must have been the next day, when the Herald put the photograph on the cover?
I do. Yeah, of course, obviously. And, you know, I've talked about this before. I get asked about it sometimes. You know, a lot of people, you know, the family and people that knew Victoria were upset by that.
And it's a photo of her laying on the sidewalk after she's been shot.
So the Herald ran a huge photo of what happened and her laying on the sidewalk. I believe it was the next day. I don't remember what the headline was.
It was Triumph and Tragedy.
Triumph and Tragedy, yeah. First of all, I have to say, that's not my decision. No, I'm the reporter, but, right. You know, I remember it being talked about in the newsroom, and I remember there being a lot of debate over whether or not to use it.
Yeah.
You know, as a father at the time, I had a young daughter. She was only 5, but, you know, I had covered a lot of tragedy in my life. And I know the way that these stories impact families. I've seen it up close and personal more than I care to think about. I knew that that was going to be upsetting to the family. Mm-hmm. But we also knew that nothing told that story more than that picture. And as hard as it was and as terrible as it was and as awful as it was, I still think it was the right decision because... Mm-hmm. The police killed a young girl on the streets of Boston during a celebration, and it shouldn't have happened. She should be alive today. And I think that, you know, the city and the world needed to see that to bring home what actually happened, to hold people accountable.
The editorial director at the time apologized for it. He got so much hate mail because of it. But after the fact, it's out there. I mean, it's the Herald, though. The Herald has that tabloid-esque reputation. It has, as long as I've been involved in media in the city.
Yeah, it does. I mean, you know, and I don't know whether or not the Globe had that photo or would have run it or wouldn't have. I don't know if they did or not, but we did, and they made that decision. And, you know, as you said, the publisher apologized. I don't think he should have. I don't think he needed to. I think it's news. And again, I mean, you look... There's pictures on the front page of newspapers all over the world every day that show people that have passed away from different incidents. And, you know, just because it upset some people in Boston doesn't mean that it didn't have news value. And again, in my opinion, nothing told the story of that night more than that picture. And it's awful, you know, and I my heart will always forever go out to the Snellgrove family. I tried to tell her a story. You know, I wrote a first person, I believe, about the incident, and then I covered the story as it unfolded, and I really tried my hardest to hold the Boston police accountable for what happened through my reporting and find out what happened. And, you know, we found out everything about those guns and how they were purchased, and what we did end up finding was that the officers weren't even trained to
That's
use
right.
them. The officers that shot them that night had never even fired those things. They were just handed them, and, you know, that superintendent who handed them those that night, you know, I believe he was held accountable. I can't remember exactly what happened. I'm sure you have it in front of you, but you know, I know that there were repercussions. I know obviously the family won a huge civil settlement against the city that was well deserved. And you know, the last thing that I am happy about is you know, my daughter actually, her mother lives in Bridgewater, and right up the street from that house is the Victoria Snellgrove Playground.
Oh yeah,
and
yeah.
I pass it every time I'm down there, and I think about her a lot. And you know, I've covered a lot of tragedy, and I've interviewed a lot of people, and I haven't seen a lot of people die in person. I've seen it, you know, 4 or 5 times, but that was about as, you know, as about as you know, about as stark a situation as I could imagine. I mean, I didn't expect it, you know, and it was right there in front of me, and all of a sudden I was like, what did I just witness? And you know, my heart has just always gone out to that family. You know,
there was a 55 page commission report after Victoria Snellgrove died. They determined it was accidental. They determined that they were not going to charge any of the officers criminally.
Mm-hmm.
The officer that was responsible for shooting her, I believe to this day, might still be on the force. I have to check that. What happened as a result?
Well, they got rid of the FN-303s. They took them away and they never used them again. And, you know, the less lethal whole sort of theory kind of went out the window. You know, what happened was, as I said, you know, they weren't trained. They were shooting them indiscriminately into a crowd at waist and above level when you're supposed to shoot them below the waist. And they're not made to, the reason they're called less lethal is if they're used properly, they're less lethal. If they're not used properly, they can be lethal, which is hitting someone in soft tissue like the neck or the eye or the mouth or the face. You know, they're still a high velocity projectile. And unfortunately, you know, that's what happened here. I think if it happened today, it would be a very, very different outcome. I think that you would probably see criminal charges against the officers. We're in a different environment today than we were in 2004. As you said, it seems like yesterday, but it wasn't. It was, you know, 17 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Different time, you know, and different mayor, you know, different horn in the country, you know.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, if it happened today, it would be a much different situation.
I really do. What, if anything, do you know about the practice that's been instituted with a police department like Boston Police Department as a result of this?
Unfortunately, it wasn't the last fatality that Boston had with celebrations from sports championships. I believe it was the following year. There was a kid that was at one of the Patriots celebrations, and I believe he got hit by a police car, I believe.
It was the same year as Victoria died.
Yeah, and then the Celtics won in 2008. There was a young man that died during a struggle with police. I think Boston police have learned a lot from these situations. I think they have gotten better at crowd control. I think that, you know, people don't like the way that the protests went in June. I believe, you know, and I watched, and I wasn't covering it anymore. I'm not doing the daily news thing anymore.
Yeah.
After the Marathon bombings, I left the Boston Herald. I was kind of burned out and had enough of news, you know.
Of tragedy.
Yeah, I took a break for a while, and I covered politics around 2005, 2006. You know, I was always getting dragged back in for these big cases, and just it wears on you every single day.
I want to ask you about that. How do you deal with that as somebody, you're a writer, you're digging in, you're looking for details to tell the right story? How do you deal with that? Because I know even writing scripts for these episodes, it's heavy.
Yeah, I guess I just, you know, I came up in hard news. There's, you know, breaking news. It's what I did for, you know, 20 years. And you just become, you know, it becomes your job. You know, you don't want to become desensitized, but you kind of do. You know, I always looked at my job like, it's no different than a police officer, a firefighter, an EMT. You do your job. In my case, it's talking to the people involved, telling the story, writing it. You know, you deal with some heavy stuff. You know, you deal with a lot of grieving people and angry people and scared people. And you know, you process it. You write the story. You leave it there. You go home, you know. And But, you know, I'm not going to sit here today and say I haven't been through a lot of therapy. You know, I mean, I also have a little bit of a unique experience in that, you know, I was at 9/11. I was also at the, you know, out in Watertown. So I, you know, and I saw things like this. So I did get a little closer than some reporters do in some cases. And I, you know, it definitely affected me. And I've had my issues over the years. I've mm-hmm. been diagnosed with PTSD a few times. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, for me, it was, you know, therapy. And, you know, I just had to compartmentalize and take care of myself, mm-hmm. you know, from a health standpoint. And mm-hmm. and I do now. And that's why I'm not in breaking news anymore. You know, I had enough.
I mean, ultimately, she died because of poor planning. And it was completely avoidable. And it's no consolation, but her family did get a settlement. There were two separate settlements, I believe, one from the city and one from the manufacturer of the weapon.
I remember that, you know, one of the issues in the, you know, post-incident analysis was the company. What did they do to make sure that the department was trained properly on the weapons? And that was part of the issue, was that they were not. And, you know, that's, they should not have even had those weapons on the truck that night. They shouldn't have even been out there.
Yeah, if no one knew how to use them, why was it even an option?
There was one guy that knew how to use them, you know, and the rest of them didn't. They were just handed these things that they had never shot before. And, you know, they weren't beanbags, you know, they were high velocity rubber bullets, basically, you know. And you know, the other thing, you know, beyond Victoria, there was several other kids that were hurt pretty bad out there. You know, they got mm-hmm. help with these things and knocked off the Green Monster while they're climbing a wall 15, 20 feet in the air. They're lucky more kids didn't get killed.
Oh, they sure are. Can you imagine what would have happened in the city if a bunch of 20-something-year-old kids got killed?
It was a bad time. And, you know, back to your question about, you know, Boston police. I think that, you know, the Boston police have learned how to exercise more restraint. They've learned better crowd control measures. Mm-hmm. They're not as aggressive. They're used to these big events. Mm-hmm. You know, before all these championships happened, really, the only thing that the Boston police ever dealt with these huge crowds was the marathon.
Yeah.
You know, that was it. And Head of the Charles, but those are very different, you know, spread out, different kind of crowds. And now, you know, when these things happen, the Boston police are much more ready for them. And I do think in June that the police showed pretty good restraint. You know, there was absolutely some incidents that shouldn't have happened out there, but, you know, they weren't running down and chasing these looters and you know, thumping them with nightclubs and shooting them, which I believe that 20 years ago, that's what would have happened. You would have had people murdered out in the streets.
Awful. And we've had enough of that nationally.
And, you know, Boston has gotten pretty good at these high security events. They've gotten better, certainly. No one's perfect, and they're never going to be. I've seen, you know, I've covered other, you know, DNC and RNC in other cities. I was in Denver for the 2008. I was in New York for 2004 Republican. And I've seen a lot of the good and bad with security. I've seen a lot of, in my career, I saw a lot of good and bad with cops. You know, I've seen the very best and the very worst. And this night was the worst. It was one of the worst I've ever seen in my career.
Yeah.
Terrible, terrible, terrible decision.
Mm-hmm. And as a result, Victoria Snellgrove, who would have today been a broadcast journalist. She was an Emerson student and she wanted to be in broadcasting. And that's something that's very close to my heart because that's what I studied, you know.
It's awful. It was an awful thing. And when I found out, you know, she's a young girl from Bridgewater and senior in college and Jesus, mm-hmm. heartbreaking story. The commissioner, Kathleen O'Toole, left shortly after that, I believe. And, you know, they never said it was because of that, but her days were numbered as soon as that happened and she had to go, you know. Mm-hmm.
What's the next book that you're writing?
So I'm actually finishing up my next book where we haven't settled fully on a title yet, but it's about a retired ATF agent who's the only federal agent to ever infiltrate the Pagans, the motorcycle club, which is the Hell's Angels rivals. And he had three little girls at home and he lived a double life, like undercover with these guys for 2 years and took down like 41 guys. It's a pretty wild story.
And you have a brand new podcast.
Yes.
Saints, Sinners, and Serial Killers.
Saints, Sinners, and Serial Killers. Yep. Up on every platform now. And
look at us.
I know, right? No, we're having fun with the podcast. It's you know, it's fun. We're doing some cool storytelling, and then we're doing some interview style stuff as well. So
right. And I must give a shout to my good friend Mike Joshua, who is your producer.
Mike's great. Mm-hmm. He's our producer, and he's doing an awesome job.
It's fantastic. Thank you.
Well, let's talk again. And
absolutely.
Anything else, let me know.
I really appreciate you taking time to talk to me. It's always awesome to see you, whether it's on screen or in person. But now that we're getting healthy, we'll all be able to meet again.
I see you at a show, right?
Yeah, right on.
All right. Yeah. Thanks.
Thank you so much. Thank you for listening. Thank you to my guest, Dave Wedge. I will link everything about him on the show page at crimeofthetruestkind.com, where you can learn about all things Crime of the Truest Kind. He has a bunch of books out now. I highly recommend Hunting Whitey, the story of the hunt and capture of legendary Boston mobster Whitey Bulger. And I did 2 episodes about Whitey Bulger, episode 1 and 2, my first 2. All right, thanks everyone. Please, if you would be so kind as to drop by Apple Podcasts and leave a 5-star review of this here program, I would greatly appreciate you. And maybe I'll share it on the show if you want me to. If you want a care package, shoot me a message or an email with your address and I will send something out to you. While supplies last, I got a bit of stuff, so. I have to quickly mention that I got my Serial Killers Are Not Hot t-shirt from Grizzly Books Podcast, and I'm doubling down on this. Serial killers are vicious and grotesque and are everything but sexy. So cut that shit out. All right, thanks for everything. I so appreciate your support of this here show. Hit me up at Buy Me a Coffee if you would like to support. You get my undying love as a reward. Oh, and this podcast. All right, I'm going to jump. Until we meet again, lock your goddamn doors.